Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, joining me today is award-winning writer Robert Hellinger. His many accolades range from the Penn Syndicated Fiction Award to the Washington Post Best Novels and the Society of Midland Authors Fiction Award. Robert Hellinger is the author of 9 novels and a collection of short stories. He's a professor emeritus at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, and he's joining us today with his latest book, Love, Death, and Rare Books. Robert Hellinger, welcome.
Very nice to be here today.
We're very pleased to have you here. Booklist calls this book an ode to physical books, their smell and feel, but also to the idea of both living life and reading about it, not choosing one over the other. And I definitely want to dive into that later, but I'd like to start our conversation off with how you grew up, basically, because it had a huge influence on you. You grew up in a small Midwestern town. Your father had a seasonal business in Wisconsin, and many of the guys who worked for him, you said, were Italian. So it ultimately exposed this young Midwestern boy to a whole new culture. What do you remember most about that, and what did you take away from those men and their culture?
Well, that division between what you might call an Italian lifestyle and the lifestyle of a small Midwestern town is one that runs through all my writing. And we lived most of the year in a small town in Michigan, but during the season, you know, as you say, it was all those people who worked for my father were Italian. And I hung out with them even from a very early age, like 14, and told my parents I was going off to the movies, but actually I went out drinking with these
men. So a whole different exposure there.
Everything was pleasure-oriented for them, whereas everything in the small town Midwest culture was work-oriented.
Mm. Well, they probably worked pretty hard if they worked in a seasonal business, so maybe they just wanted to let rip when they weren't working. Was that the case?
Yes, I think so, although they work very long hours in the summer.
Yeah, yeah. So you've been writing for a long time, over 40 years. You began writing fiction at Knox, where you taught for many years. Your first story was published over 40 years ago, your first novel over 20 years ago. What point did you know you wanted to write?
It's kind of hard to say. When I came to Knox, my specialty was English Renaissance literature, and I thought at the time, let's get down to the real hard stuff. Knox has a very strong undergraduate creative writing program, one of the first in the country. So there was a lot of hype there, and I thought, well, the students wrote these stories and people made a fuss about it. I said, I can do that, and maybe somebody will make a fuss about me. And that's what happened.
Right, so let's look at the story a little bit of Love, Death, and Rare Books. I mean, I'm guessing anybody who loves books is going to be really interested in reading this. The story characters, let's introduce those. We've got Gabe Johnson, who's the grandson, Charles Johnson, his father, and then Charles' father, who's Gabe's grandfather, Charles Sr. And they run a rare bookstore in Chicago's Hyde Park. And then along comes this fabulous thing called the internet, which doesn't do much for their business, right? And they're forced to close it.
Right. It created a lot of turmoil. There was a lot of, like the O'Gara and Wilson in Chicago, downsized to a smaller store in Chesterton, Indiana. A lot of these big old barns that used to dot the countryside had to close. And there used to be these great, huge, monstrous stores in the inner city. They couldn't keep going. They couldn't keep up with the rents. On the other hand, the internet made it possible for a mom-and-pop operation or for smaller operations or for different kinds of operations to keep going. and sort of rebrand the whole business. It made it easier for collectors to put together meaningful collections.
Right. And so I know you had to do a lot of research for this book, Robert, because you go, you know, the rare book business wasn't something in your back pocket there. You went out and researched this. Tell us some of the things that surprised you about the rare book industry and maybe shocked you.
Well, I've already mentioned the first thing. I signed up for a seminar, the Colorado Antiquarian Book Seminar, which is really quite an important institution for people who want to break into the rare book business or people who want to refresh their skills in it. And the first thing, I was sharing my proposed inventory with one of the instructors, and he said, you know, you have to know how to sell a $100,000 book. No one here has sold a $100,000 book. And I knew right away that I was in trouble, that I didn't understand anything about the rare book business. So we took it from there, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot about how much hard work it is. I wanted to include some of the high-end books because those prices are exciting. You want to buy a copy of Champlain's Voyage to the New France, $350,000.
Oh, wow.
Free shipping.
Wow. Free shipping. I'd want it delivered on a gold platter for that much.
There's this amazing high-powered world of collecting and whatnot.
Right. What gave you the idea to write about rare books as just make it a regular bookstore?
We vacationed in Michigan. I saw this house on the lake. And that house on the lake was the starting point. But then at the same time, that was around 2013, O'Gara and Wilson, this big store in Chicago, closed. And then that store sort of took over the story for me. It no longer was a story about this romantic house on the lake. It became a story about downsizing a large old rare bookstore into a new location.
Mm-hmm. So going along the storyline here, Gabe, who is the grandson, he's ready to take over the reins of the bookstore and everything. And he's having to reassess the business because of the changing environment, of course, and the way people that consume books. And it takes him on this journey where he also reassesses his own life. And he's had this obsession, it seems like most of his life, with this woman called Olivia, who he met and fell in love with at college. And then she moved away, but she kind of weaved in and out of his life throughout the years. Why did you include this? Now, I want to just tie it together because I read in many, many reviews of your books that all of your books have a love and loss theme. So talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
The funny thing is, I tried to avoid that. I'd say, oh, we've got to add the love interest. But I couldn't do without it. It just worked her way in there as someone working in the store as an apprentice, and then she becomes, what I did do was make her a very problematic character. She is not an innocent. She more or less traps Gabe into marrying her, and I like that because it gave a kind of harder edge to it, not just, oh, isn't it nice that these childhood sweethearts finally got together.
Right.
So she's a very tough woman, and, well, I think things work out for them, but...
So his mother, the story begins in 1970 when his mother disappeared. And do you think part of his obsession with Olivia was that his mother had disappeared and here's Olivia who keeps disappearing on him?
Well, it could be because the mother who disappears keeps recurring. In the first installment, the mother dies. But as it goes on, she disappears in different ways. She's always on the edge, and Gabe has to deal with that. Sadness, she often goes off to Italy with someone. Mm. There's that Italian theme.
Right.
And the idea of the Italian lover who gets in the way of the family life. And I don't know why I fixated on that, but I always liked that idea. It seemed sad.
Yes, there is a certain, well, there is a lot of element of sadness to that, I think, for a child and mother who's separated. Yeah. I said at the beginning that Booklist calls this book an ode to physical books, their smell and feel, but also to the idea of living life and reading about it, not choosing one over the other. And one thing that Olivia said to Gabe, and his mother had said to Gabe, and many people said to Gabe, who came into the bookstore, was, I want to live life, not read about it. So do you think the Booklist description is accurate?
Well, I think so. To me, it's easy to misunderstand that. I want to live life, not read about it. I want to go out and play tennis and go boating and have all sorts of adventures. To me, the reading is a clarification of life, and it's a way to get your experience into words so that you can hold it up to the light and understand what your life is all about and what you're going through. I've never felt that those two were at odds, as they seem to be.
Right. No, I think I can think of many books that I found validating and let me know that, hey, you know, heck, I'm not the only one who felt this way or is feeling this way. So I think there's a lot of validation in that. I'm curious who your favorite character is in the book.
Oh, it has to be Gabe. This is closest to me.
Oh, closest to you, okay. And what? How is he closest to you?
Well, it's his story. He's the one who's driven by his vocation. Now, if I could use one word for this novel, it would be vocation. Gabe sticks to his vocation. He is tempted away from his vocation. His father is disillusioned at the end. He says, Gabe, cocker up your genius and live free. Go buy a farm near Montaigne's old place in France. Rent an apartment in the center of Rome. Go into business with your college pal in New York. And Olivia is, in a way, the last temptation. They're all pulling him away from the vocation. And he has to pull back. And he comes close to giving way, so to speak. But he does pull back and reaffirms his dedication to the rare book business.
Mm. Have you had a similar challenge in your life? I'm wondering. I know you describe yourself, you say you're married, you've traveled with your wife a lot, lived extensively overseas. You have three daughters, but unlike King Lear, you say you will get on. So have you had a similar kind of challenge in your own life?
No, except in the sense that the shift from seeing myself as a scholar, teacher of Renaissance literature and Romantic literature, the shift to writing fiction was a pretty big pull. Now, I never felt that one was getting in the way of the other, but it was a pretty big shift.
Right, different process, different point of view, all that stuff.
My whole sense of identity was different then.
Yeah. So I think you wrote your first novel in the 90s, 1990s. What do you know now when you're writing Love, Death and Rare Books, your latest, what do you know now that you wish you had known back then when you wrote your first novel?
I know how important it is to get a timeline of events that happen in the story, because no matter how careful I've been, I always run into a lot of grief. When did this happen? When did that happen? It could not have happened this way because there's not enough time, and so on. You'd think that'd be pretty simple, but it's been a hard lesson to learn, and I still have trouble keeping track of things.
Right. So what's the process like for you then? Do you actually plot out your whole story first, your timeline?
No, the idea is to keep revising the timeline as I go along so I can track the story. But when you're in the middle of writing, you don't feel like setting everything aside and going back and looking at the calendar. So things inevitably get mixed up. In the second novel, for example, Woody has a stint in the army. Well, it would have been impossible given his life story. There's not room for it chronologically. And an editor will jump on that, and then trying to sort out something like that can be a real mess.
Well, it's an interesting story, Robert, and you know, as somebody who likes physical books as opposed to ebooks, I hope physical books never, ever, ever go away.
Yes.
Yeah. I know you'd like to read to us. You have a little passage or a passage to read to us today, and I'd like to ask you if you could do that for us now.
Okay, now I'm going to keep this short. This is at the opening of the bookstore, and a man has stood up at the opening. He's waving his Kindle around. Gabe is selling a copy of the Gettysburg Address. And this man says, you know, I got 10 copies of the Gettysburg Address right on his Kindle. They didn't cost me a dime. And Gabe feels very tired, but he rises to that challenge. Mr. Stevens, I said, if you're one of those people who think books, I mean books as physical objects, not texts, should be consigned to the rubbish heap of history, then there's not much I can say to you. But I think you fail to understand that people don't just read books. They live with books. Books become part of their lives. They loan books to their friends. They give them to their children, to their friends and lovers. They borrow books. They collect books. They arrange books on their shelves, and then they rearrange them. Nothing is more beautiful than a room full of books. Nothing. They inscribe books to their lovers and their husbands and wives. They inscribe them to their children and to their parents. The book as a physical object is the end of a product of a long and complicated process that has a long and complicated history. Think about your own library. Every one of those books has its own story to tell. You start with a few books, and then you add a few more every year. After a while, you have a personal library, a library that tells your story in a profound way, and it's right there for you, on your shelves, the books you read as a child, if you're lucky enough to still have them, the book your mother gave you for Christmas the year your father died, the book your dad left behind in his study, the book that named your experience, the books that opened your eyes.
I love that, Robert. I love that. I love it so much because I have books that my grandmother had in 1890 when she was born. And then I have books that my mother wrote in as a child when they were given to her. And I can never give those away. So I really love that passage. I'm glad you chose that passage. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're at the end of our segment. So I want to ask you, I want to let listeners know, first of all, they can find out much more about you and your work at roberthellinger.com, roberthellinger.com. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Robert?
Well, here's a piece of advice. Always be open to surprises in your writing. It's never too late to change things. And when surprise comes along, welcome it.
I love it. I think that's a great advice for life too in general. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I appreciate you being with us today, Robert. Again, listeners can find out much more about Robert and his work at roberthellinger.com. The book again is Love, Death, and Rare Books. And if you have questions, comments, or feedback on today's show, you can reach me through our website, conversationslive.net. You'll find more than 700 podcasts and more than 1,200 guest interviews up there, conversationslive.net. And I want to thank each of you for joining us today. Until next week, stay safe, stay strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.